Welcome to Groundwire Community Radio News, a show by volunteers at Canada's community radio stations. This week's Groundwire was produced at CILU FM on Fort William First Nations Anishinaabe Traditional Territory in Thunder Bay, Ontario. I'm your host and producer, Carly Forbes. In this edition, we'll feature the voices of immigration detainees currently on hunger strike in Lindsay, Ontario, an interview with the co-founder of the Full Moon Memory Walk in Thunder Bay, a report on the Human Rights Museum's refusal to use the word genocide in an exhibit about Aboriginal people in Canada, live coverage of the Truth and Reconciliation event on the West Coast, and a community radio news report about the end of free speech radio news. But first, here's the headlines. Federal prisoners in Ontario, Saskatchewan, Quebec, and New Brunswick are currently on work strikes in protest of the new Offender Accountability Initiative. Yasmin from Prison Radio CKUT gives an overview of the changes.
Federally sentenced prisoners have been informed that 30% of their gross pay, if they are pay levels A through D, will be deducted for room and board and administration of the telephone system. This percentage doesn't change even if they are double bunked, which more and more are. They will pay this 30% on their inmate pay and on any other sources of income. Keep in mind, the maximum pay rate is only $69 every other week. So for the top of scale worker, $15.18 of his or her $69 pay will go directly to pay for being incarcerated. $5.52 will be paid by the prisoner for the staff to administer the phone system. They will still have to buy their own phone cards. Another $3 will go to the inmate welfare fund. And then there is the savings account. Prisoners are now required to keep $200 in their savings account. This is raised from $80. So until you have this amount in your account, they will deduct 10% after deductions. If they get approval from administration, they can use some of their savings for, and I swear that this is an exact quote, essential medical expenses and a few other items. For example, Aboriginal spiritual services, ceremonies, traditional healing practices, getting ID for when they are released. Prisoners working at CORCAN will no longer receive incentive pay. The government indicates that the benefit of working for CORCAN is sufficient and that this is the only justification in the documents that the prisoners were given. Prisoners will not be able to purchase specialty items that require a CS staff member to shop in person. If it isn't an approved catalog or on an approved list, they can't have it.
Peter Collins, a lifer imprisoned in Bath, Ontario, shares how it's going to affect federal prisoners.
It's going to affect us in a lot of different ways, you know. So I guess initially the most damaging way is the cost. You know, they're gonna take 30% of our pay, and we haven't had a pay increase since 1981.
A rally in March took place in response to the publishing of a highly transphobic editorial by the Thunder Bay Chronicle Herald. J.L. Chung from the Lakehead Gender Issues Center spoke at the rally.
We are here to show that our community cares and is one with passionate people who stand united to challenge discrimination and continue to work to make this an inclusive and safe place to live. I'm here because I take issue with the misinformation and dangerous, hurtful language used in the editorial Sexual Rights Public Norms. The language is damaging because it takes away the opportunity to understand trans people and to see a person for who they are. The editorial doesn't recognize its privilege held as author. Instead, the editorial brings out a fearful, uninformed voice and troubled point of view. It's the statements and ideas of the author that we read and need to rewrite. It's the words that cause hurt and fear that I let go of because they don't serve us anymore. They don't bring us up, they bring us down. No more of this. I want to know that we are safe, that we are present, we are loud, and we aren't afraid to take our space. Isn't it amazing to have a voice and to exercise our rights? I hope you'll help me too.
I also spoke with Sarah DiBaggio, one of the rally organizers, about the response she's had from the editor of the Chronicle Herald.
So myself and JL over there both talked with him, and we gave him the petition. I explained to him what was on the petition, who was supporting the petition, what we were asking, and he stated that they would not be issuing an apology for the offensive language used and lack of content expressed throughout. He also offered us a meeting in the future to further discuss the issue at hand, which I am personally really looking forward to, because the Chronicle Journal doesn't seem to think that they've crossed any line in publishing this.
Despite their meeting with the editor of the Chronicle Herald, the paper refuses to apologize for publishing this transphobic editorial. Now it's time for our feature stories. In the center of Winnipeg, at the Forks, where the Red and Assiniboine Rivers meet, a historic institution is on the verge of opening to the public. The Canadian Human Rights Museum is to be the first new national museum built in Canada since 1967. It was conceived by its founder, the late media mogul Izzy Asper, as a place where Canadian students could gather and learn more about human rights. Over the summer, however, the museum has generated scorn from Indigenous peoples and their allies. Michael Welsh of CKUW in Winnipeg has more.
Over the summer, outrage was sparked among First Nations and their allies when a Winnipeg newspaper article disclosed that the Canadian Human Rights Museum in downtown Winnipeg was rejecting the use of the term genocide to describe an exhibit featuring the Canadian state's treatments of its Indigenous peoples. Maureen Fitzhenry, a museum spokesperson, explains further.
If you're asking about under what circumstances would we call something and describe it ourselves as a genocide, we would do that in a number of circumstances. When there is government recognition, when there is a legal court ruling or a legal tribunal ruling, or when there is a broad base of consensus and scholarly opinion and established use of the term.
Nigan Wewedam, James Sinclair, is Anishinaabe and an associate professor at the University of Manitoba. He's not impressed with the museum's position.
Not only do scholars or academics, people in my work, recognize it, and we're not talking about First Nations people, we're talking about non-First Nations people, who would recognize Canada's treatment of First Nations people as genocide. We have Jewish people who have experienced the Holocaust say Canada's treatment of First Nations people is genocide, and writing articles about it. I mean, how much more do you need?
My name is Chris Powell. I'm a professor of sociology at Ryerson University. I specialize in social theory, and I've written a book on genocide. I've been studying genocide over the last 10 years. There's a growing recognition among scholars that that what happened could be considered genocide, and a decision to label it as such. That's not a consensus. The common sense 10 years ago was very much oriented to seeing genocide in terms of mass murder, and only in terms of mass murder. And it's just been, I think, in the last kind of generation of scholarship that has really shifted. So there isn't a consensus, but I think there's a growing recognition among the more active scholars who are writing about this issue.
We do have to be careful, though, especially when things are a public debate, a current public debate, that we don't wade in and take the role of advocate or be perceived as taking the role of advocate, because that's not appropriate for a museum. So we are using the word genocide in our museum to talk about efforts by the community to have the treatment of Canada's Aboriginal people described and declared a genocide. It's just all we're doing is there's one title of one wall in one exhibit where we decided that the label shouldn't be genocide. The label should be some different words because we were worried that people would think we had decided that we had waded into the debate that's currently on and decided.
For me, as somebody who's interested in human rights, that's really disappointing. It would seem like the purpose of a public institution dedicated to human rights would be precisely to take difficult and controversial political stands. So it's disappointing to see the museum shying away from that.
My name is Clint Crow. I work for the Canadian Museum for Human Rights, and my role there is I'm head of stakeholder relations. I can't tell you how many times in the last few weeks I've heard people discussing the work of Raphael Lemkin, who, you know, is really a kind of an obscure scholar who, you know, in the 1940s invented the term genocide. And, you know, the conversations that we're seeing now where people are digging up Lemkin's work, seeing to what extent his concept of genocide can fit the history of what's happened in Canada and what was done in Canada to the Indigenous people. That is so positive, right? This is great. And so from the point of view of humanist education and the point of view of promoting serious humanist culture in Canada and facing our own history with courage and honesty, this is wonderful.
And so what's at stake for people who advocate the use of the term genocide is the idea that Indigenous cultures have something that's worth preserving, that's important to preserve and to revitalize and to make space for within Canada.
For many, the debate about whether or not Canada's abuses of its Indigenous population has been settled for years. Whether or not the Human Rights Museum should take on an advocacy role to better serve its mandate is another question. From downtown Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Aking territory, this is Michael Welch of CKUW, assisted by Chris Reed and Jordan Poitras, reporting for Groundwire.
Truth and Reconciliation events and rallies took place all over the West Coast, including a large march in Coast Salish territory, downtown Vancouver, on Sunday, September 22nd, that some estimate drew more than 10,000 people. And now we'll go to live coverage of a Truth and Reconciliation walk that took place in Sliman First Nation territory that was broadcast live on CJMP Powell River Radio.
This event is the culmination of a week-long Truth and Reconciliation Week in BC. And this has been happening throughout the province, with the main events happening in Vancouver, where people have come from all over to courageously share their stories about their experiences in residential school. So today, people in Powell River region have come to bear witness and to begin the road of reconciliation together here with the Tsleil-Waututh Nation.
Oh, well, we're here because we've been in, most of our life been in residential school. So we're big advocates, I guess. My sister and I and my niece there, Jennifer, is a, her mom was also in residential school. Yeah.
And what do you hope that will come out of this,
just more recognition, people being more aware of, you know, where everybody, where the people come from, and bringing back history.
Well, for me, it's really important because I'm a residential school survivor. I've seen all the hurts and everything that has gone on in those places, and we had no choice. So there has to be an understanding of those policies that put the First Nation in these situations, you may call it. And getting out of it, to me, is like releasing. And part of the reconciliation is about telling the truth. And that's what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is all about. So the truth has to come out. And it's one thing for us to heal from what has happened, and the other side of it is what caused it. So that has to change. You know, I see this as a beginning. Even though that part is an end, there's a new beginning that's happening. And hopefully things will... When people start to hear the stories, then they'll start to understand why are people the way they are. We just didn't become like this. It's the policies that have been developed, you know, the reserve system, the Indian Act, the residential school is just the one issue that we're dealing with. So for me, it's kind of like an acknowledgement. But there's still a lot of work to be done yet.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you. Can you tell me your name?
Oh, Jean-Louis.
Right, thank you, John.
My name is Brian Keogh. I'm part of the Youth Council. And I just wanted to say thank you to all of the elders and everyone who survived the residential school and who didn't lose themselves while they were there and who never forgot our culture and our language. so that we can carry it on for generations to come. And my newborn little niece, she'll grow up with the language because you guys were so strong. And you decided, no, we won't give up. And she'll grow up with our culture. So that means a lot. Thank you.
We will tell a story. We will tell a story.
What you just heard was brought to you from Land and Territory by CJMP's Claudia Medina and Courtney Harrop as part of CJMP's Remote Outreach Broadcasting Program. For more information on the Tlamin Nation, please visit www.tlaminfirstnation.com.
191 detainees on immigration hold in the maximum security prison in Lindsay, Ontario, have been on general strike since September 17th. These migrants are kept locked in cages for 18 to 22 hours a day, some of them for up to 7 years, because Canada cannot deport them to home countries that will not take them back. In contravention of the United Nations High Commission on Human Rights, Canada refuses to release them. Candice Cascanet from CKUT Montreal spoke with Syed Hassan from No One Is Illegal Toronto.
Canadian laws, unlike U.S., British, and other European laws, where you know you have 6 months, if you can't deport someone, you have to freedom, Canada has no such process. It's indefinite detention. Basically, people are being held who have prior, who have criminal convictions, and that's actually a double mind. So once you have a conviction and you've served your sentence, Canada, you don't actually get released from prison. You are actually moved into immigration detention while they try and process your deportation. Now, that could take between 9 months to, you know, 5 years.
Many of the migrants who are currently imprisoned have been on hunger strike since September 26th. At least 6 detainees have been hospitalized or received medical treatment, and at least one is on a dry hunger strike, meaning no food and no water. The detainees are also collectively boycotting their detention review hearings, which have become a charade with no hope for release. Mina Ramos and Josh Gilbert from Forza Porza in Guelph spoke with two hunger-striking migrants currently detained at the Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario.
As the health of many individuals steadily declines, detainees are continuing to stress that services be made accessible while in the facility, including better access to international calls, legal aid, and legal services, while demanding that there be an end to long-term detention, and in the meantime that they be moved to facilities closer to their communities and legal services. The following interviews took place with immigration detainees Eric Kusi on Thursday, September 26th, and detainee Jalal Josto on Saturday, September 28th.
My name is Eric Kusi. And I'm 48 years old, from Liberia, West Africa, in Africa. I came here in 1989, and seek political refugee. Everybody is locked down right now, looking at me right now on the phone. I told everybody that I'm going to go call you. Hold on, huh? Oh! They took him? Yeah, they took somebody too.
They took somebody? Do you know where they took him?
No, I don't know where, but they took him from other side, other range.
Even though Craig Keelan is saying that CBSA is going to meet up with you, basically they're still cracking down on people in different ranges who are participating in the strike.
Yes, basically that's what it is.
Have you guys been giving access to make international calls?
No.
How are people feeling having been on hunger strike?
Frustration, headaches, angry, and among ourselves, too much yelling going around. It's kind of stressing out people down right now. I'm getting frustrated myself. Please let everybody know that we thank them. We appreciate their work and their time and support.
And detainee Jalal Justone.
I'm from Iraq. I was living in Canada 9 years before. All together, I'm living in Canada like 16 years. I've been in jail almost 7 years. Immigration hold, I've been in 2 years. I can't even see my son, you know, they can afford to drive. Well, I'm from Windsor, I'm not from Toronto, all the way from Windsor. Yeah, from Windsor, they can't drive over here, now 6 hours. I was in Toronto, it was 4 hours, I'm from here. From Windsor to here, 6 hours. You know, I haven't seen my son for 7 years.
There's even people in your case who are willing to be surety for you, to get you out of
out of prison, but the CBSA is denying that.
They didn't even interview them. They denied me bail without interviewing them.
This is so inspiring. The 200 undocumented people, in the midst of such brutish conditions, denied all of these things, placed in cages for 18 hours, have chosen to respond with action, have chosen to respond with militant action and actually putting their lives and their bodies on the line by refusing to eat, by refusing to go into cells until, you know, Riot Squad actually pushed them back in, which was the first day of the strike. And you know, that's a call, you know, that's a massive call to see, okay, people are fighting back in these extremely unjust and, you know, oppressive conditions, and it is, you know, our responsibility to respond, at least with as much courage.
As immigration detainees continue their hunger strike, it is crucial that individuals on the outside take action. If you have the time, please visit our website at endimmigrationdetention.wordpress.com and sign the petition posted.
On Thursday, September 9th, the annual Full Moon Memory Walk took place in Thunder Bay, Ontario. Around 100 community members gathered together to honor the lives of the missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls. I had an opportunity to speak with Sharon Johnson, one of the founders of the Full Moon Memory Walk in Thunder Bay.
We started the memorial walk, two of us. Had this idea to do something more to raise awareness about the unsolved cases, the many unsolved cases of missing and murdered Aboriginal women, and with my own sister's unsolved murder since 1992, I decided I would be a part of that. Starting a memorial walk just to raise awareness. We believe that the Grandmother Moon it cleanses us. It's a powerful time, you know. There's ceremonies, there's full moon ceremonies that happen all over the place, and one of the reasons why we picked September as well, and also because that was the month that my sister, my late sister, was born. The most important part of the walk for me would be the ceremonies that we include as part of this walk. For me, being an Ojibwe, I practice my culture, and I didn't always do that. I only started to learn about and practice my culture just around the time my sister was murdered in 1992, and even then I wasn't comfortable with doing that, with practicing those teachings. But I only started to include them as part of the memorial walk, because for me, to honor the memories of the women that lost their lives that way, you know, by using our ceremonies, I think it makes it that much more powerful to include that, because to me that's what's important, and that's what I was taught by my parents, and I know that's what my late little sister was also. That was something that she believed in. So yeah, that was the most important thing for me.
On October 4th, in many communities from coast to coast, Sisters in Spirit vigils are held every year to honor the lives of missing and murdered Aboriginal women and to raise awareness of the alarmingly high rate of missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls in Canada. Sharon Johnson and her family will be traveling to Ottawa to attend the vigil on Parliament Hill.
The annual vigils held across Canada, I'm not sure how much there are now, but there's lots. They're happening all over, like small towns and cities. And but this one here that we attend in Ottawa, it's on Parliament Hill. And I think for my family, it's something that we started doing as an annual thing, you know, and it's like a time for us to get together and to talk about you know, to talk about where we're at in terms of our own healing as a family and how we can continue to help other families. I encourage people to to find out about vigils in their area to help support the family members.
The periodic review by the UN Human Rights Council of Canada, one of the primary recommendations was for a national inquiry into the missing and murdered Aboriginal women and girls in Canada. The Harper government refuses to take action. Later this month, James Anaya, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, is scheduled to visit Canada and conduct his own inquiry. And now it's time for Groundwire's Community Radio Report. Aaron Lakoff brings us a report about the end of Free Speech Radio News.
Since 2000, Free Speech Radio News, or FSRN, has been producing a daily half-hour international newscast, which was syndicated on over 100 radio stations across North America. FSRN's focus was on social justice stories told by voices around the world. The program was born out of a labor dispute at Pacifica Radio, a community radio network in the United States. In January 2000, the Pacifica executive director and the board of directors were accused by some members of practicing censorship and corporatizing the network. In response, a group of Pacifica freelance journalists went on strike and began producing their own newscast, Free Speech Radio News. Their strike ended in 2002, when FSRN officially joined the Pacifica network. On September 13th of this year, FSRN's board of directors issued a two-week layoff notice to all staff, and their last daily program went to air on September 27th. FSRN cited a major funding shortfall as the reasoning for going off the air. The program's production costs are $36,000 US per month, but they were only getting $10,000 per month from Pacifica Radio, their main funder, and oftentimes having to rely on emergency fundraising campaigns from their listeners and supporters. Russell Gregg is the treasurer of the board of directors of FSRN, as well as a member of CKDU Radio in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He spoke with Groundwire about the importance of FSRN.
What we're losing is a unique program in especially the North American media landscape. It's the only daily newscast of its kind where not only is the focus on underrepresented demographics and underreported or unreported stories. But the key is that our reporters on six continents are reporting from essentially their home bases. So we're not flying in foreign correspondents to cover these stories. These are the people that are living with these issues and are affected by these stories day to day. So it brings a primacy and an immediacy and an intimacy that you don't get in any commercial.
According
media.
To a statement released from FSRN, they had produced 3,400 programs and specials featuring more than 20,000 reporter headlines and features since the program's inception. While the future remains unclear, the board is meeting to discuss a long-term plan for getting FSRN back on the airwaves. They say it might take a new form, which would either be a weekly news program or a daily headline service. For more updates and developments, or to listen to the program archives, listeners can visit www.fsrn.org. For Groundwire, this is Aaron Lakoff from CKUT Radio in Montreal.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire. From CILU, in Thunder Bay, on Fort William, First Nations, Anishinaabe Traditional Territory, I'm Carly Forbes. Thank you to Prison Radio CKUT, Candace Kaskinet, Aaron Lakoff, Michael Welsh, Jordan Poitras, Chris Reed, Mina Ramos, Josh Gilbert, Courtney Harrop, and Claudia Mendino. Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station. Or download it at groundwire.ncra.ca. Groundwire is a project of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.